Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. This is going to be our final Bible study on the Gospel of Thomas, despite the fact that we are not quite finished with it, but this is how it goes sometimes. Thank you for your patience, and I beg a bit more of it as people begin to enter the room.
Hi.
Can you hear me? Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
And I'm sorry that this is our last meeting. I will miss it. I've enjoyed it and learned a lot. So
thank you very much. Let's wait and see if anyone else is going to join us. I know that Grace is doing some things with her husband right now. And so we will miss her, but this is how it goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I have, before you get into some of the logions, I have a question for you. So a fundamental question on, book of.
Well, why don't you go ahead and ask that now?
Oh, okay. On the back of this book,
yes,
by Leilu, on the back of that book, there's a sentence that says, "The Jesus of Thomas invites us to drink deeply from the well of knowledge that lies within, not so that we may become good Christians, but so that we may attain the self-knowledge that will make each of us to a Christ." Now, this just astounds me. And this concept of self-knowledge, there's a short little logion, number 67, that it really focuses on it. I mean, it's in a lot of the logions, but 67 really focuses on it and the importance of this self-knowledge. So I want you to explain what they mean by self-knowledge and how in the world will it make each of us a Christ. This is astounding to me.
Okay.
And unbelievable because I don't understand it.
Okay. Well, let's dig into that.
Okay.
So it seems like Leilu here is comparing and contrasting in his statement two different things, which some people do not separate. And so for the people who don't separate them, it may seem like he's splitting hairs. He's being unnecessarily obtuse and he just needs to cut that out. And that's a fair criticism, because if you really don't see the difference, then yeah, he's just splitting hairs. But Leilu seems to be comparing and contrasting the idea of participating in a religion, being religious, with a deep kind of gnosis. And by that, I mean specifically the definition of it's knowledge, but it's knowledge that's seeped into your bones. So it's knowledge, but it's also action, and it's a deep awareness. It's the deepest knowing that we can have. So a deep knowing of the presence of God in your life, and the will of God in your life, and the love of God in your life. It seems like he's comparing and contrasting following a religion and participating in all of the outward trappings of religion, mm-hmm. and actually going deep in your own relationship with God as deep as you can go. So now I understand that for some people that is splitting a hair, because mm-hmm. that is the point of religion.
Okay, can I bring up a point?
Go for it.
In Logion 67, in his commentary, he says, this self-knowledge, so fundamental to the Gospel of Thomas, and it's true, it's everywhere, has nothing to do with self-analysis or narcissistic introspection. It is the process of keenly observing our actions and emotions without judging or explaining them. In this attentive regard, neutral and compassionate, we discover what is and who we are. Does it say anything about God? And also it says, without self-analysis, and without explaining these things, But that's not knowledge. If you don't analyze and explain things, that's not knowledge. That's just data. You know, if you're just observing, you know, your reactions and emotions, you know, without really kind of studying them, you're not learning, you're not gaining knowledge about yourself. I mean, to gain knowledge, it seems to me you would have to analyze things. Well, first of all, what do I want to know about myself? Well, my values, which is most important, and rank order them. And then maybe who do I love and like and why, you know, what are the traits that I appreciate, and should I change my attitude and look, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, to me, there's a lot of self-analysis and explaining that's required. And he said, this, you don't do that. You know, you just observe, you know, right. And if you just observe, you don't learn anything, you know.
Okay.
You know, and in his explanation, he doesn't say anything about God. You were talking about God, studying our relation, our inner deepest relationship with God. He doesn't say anything about that.
Okay, pause for a moment.
Okay.
Because you bring up a very good point. And it seems to me that what you're doing is describing the difference in point of view between a contemplative and an intellectual. Let me elaborate. I would categorize Lelou's point of view as contemplative. So what that means is the way Lelou can most closely approach God is through utterly quiet internal observation with no analysis, no judgment, just quiet observation. And that is a bona fide and highly documented method of gaining closeness with God. And what you're describing as the way that you see the world and what would make most sense to you is much more of an intellectual approach to think and to reason and to do some analysis and to discover knowledge, to turn data into a kind of data that has perspective and understanding and a place in the world. And I mean, in truth, that is a way toward God. It is not Lelou's way toward God. And so what he is describing, I think, is a very accurate and useful method for people who are inclined toward contemplation. And by that, I mean, any kind of meditation, anyone who likes to meditate might be more inclined toward this contemplative path. But just because the contemplative path exists doesn't mean that everybody has to take it. And what Lelou is, I think, and this is my interpretation, you understand. Lelou, if you were sitting right here next to me, he might say something different. But he's not, so we have to do our best. What I think Lelou is circling around is this idea that even in our most rational minds, even when we are filled with the Spirit of God, whatever that looks like for us, words are still not enough to communicate who God really is, what God really is. Now, we can throw words at the concept and we can come really close, but we'll never hit the bullseye. We'll never get it fully, completely, exactly right because words fail us. God is literally ineffable and unable to be described by something as puny as the English language or even the Greek language, which, you know, Greeks will be happy to inform you is much better than English. But so Lelou is, I think, kind of circling around how do you discover the nature of God inside of you without trying to use words, without trying to throw words at the idea like someone in an intellectual path might do. I'm a big fan of words, me. I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller. Words are all I got. And so as much as I enjoy meditation, I also lean toward the intellectualization. The problem, there's a problem with both of these ways, because there's a problem with every way. When you lean more toward the contemplative, the meditative path, you can get lost in the nothingness and miss the idea that you're actually waiting on God. And when you take the path of the intellectual, as I also favor doing, you can get lost. I can get lost in explaining exactly how God seems to be and not actually participating in the relationship. Like, I can spend a lot of time describing the relationship and describing my problems and describing how God heals my problems without actually working on the healing with God of my problems. And so, you know, there are other paths, which I'm not going to muddy the waters with and bring up at this moment, but there are other paths, and each one has strengths and each one has weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And it seems very clear to me that we're encountering one person on one path saying, but your path doesn't make sense to me. And Leilu may be like, you know, but your path doesn't make sense to me either.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. I mean, this whole concept of knowledge and self-knowledge, to me, it has to be very analytical and understandable. You know, you have to be able to, you know, as I said, you know, make hierarchies of things and networks and see how things relate to each other and really get in and understand the details of your feelings and your thoughts and your relationships and your values and, you know, on and on and on, you know, and what God is and what he means to you and what some of these descriptions, like, why do they call him unity? Why do they call him openness? And things like that, you know, what do you mean by these terms, you know, and the all with a capital A, you know, what the hell is that, you know, but
hold on.
Do you mean by that? Yeah.
Right. Let's see. Sue, what do you think about this? Because you seem to be a sort of person who is a bit more contemplative. Do you want to weigh in?
I definitely fall in that category. And I find in that category is that every time I start analyzing myself, I am leaning extremely heavily into the narcissism of me. And like I'm the only person in the universe dealing with this problem. So when I'm contemplative and just quiet, one, that works because it's hard to separate those two dynamics. But when I manage that, there's just a peace that is indescribable. You just kind of know you're not alone. You're with grace. You're just different.
Right.
And so that's when I seem afterwards to have ideas that make better sense.
And so what Sue is describing then is through contemplation, she reaches the peace that passes all understanding. And a very visceral and tangible feeling of the presence of God. Now, I just came across my copy of Brother Lawrence's The Practice of the Presence of God, which is a very slim little volume about a monk who lived centuries ago and found God through doing dishes, which he hates doing. And that was his practice. Like, you know, in the monastery, this was the job he got assigned. And with a fiery passion, he hated doing the dishes. He hated kitchen duty. But he worked through what he hated in order to come out the other end of it and experience the presence of God. And part of the felt experience of the presence of God, it is a knowing, but it's not necessarily a knowing with words. And it is It is unlike anything else we experience. It is totally wholesome. It is completely good. And it can reassure us because it happens inside of us that we really are the children of God because we are capable of this. And we can go inside and be with God. And so that, I think, brings us back to the end of the statement at the back of the book, so that we may attain the self-knowledge that will make each of us to a Christ. And, you know, he uses the word make us a Christ. I would say wherein we discover the Christ that is already within us. Mm-hmm. That place, you call it a place, but it's not really a place. The place where we are wholly at peace with God. And that some people get there through contemplation, and some people get there through doing the dishes. Marilyn, are you able to weigh in?
I was just kind of wondering myself. I mean, I see all of you now, and I'm listening, but I didn't know how far that went. I didn't know if it was reversed. So yes, the answer is yes, I guess.
Excellent. Well, you don't have any video, but that's all right. We know who you are.
I have video on my end. I was just about to turn it off, though, and run down to the church because it seemed like that might be better. I don't know. But as long as I can hear you, that's fine, I guess, you know.
Yeah. So I was going to ask those present, since this is going to be our last session and we are halfway through, do you want to just do a couple more logion? Do you want to have, a more overarching conversation about the Gospel of Thomas? Do you want to go through and do some of the future? Oh, hello, we see you. Do you want to go through and discuss some of the future logions? What would you like?
I think I would appreciate a more overview, pull the important things, focus on the important things and, for the book of the Gospel of Thomas.
Okay.
Anybody else wanna vote?
Marilyn, what's your opinion?
Well, it'd be like continuing, right? To sort of squishing it all together, what's left? You're talking about the rest of the meeting,
today's for
meeting, right?
Right. For the next 40 minutes, how do we want to spend it? Since this is the last time we'll have Bible study together like this, do you want to just do Logion 61 and then 62 and then 63?
No.
No. All right. There's one vote for no. Or do you want to have a more wider ranging conversation about kind of summarizing and tying up the work that we've done? That's the question.
I vote for the latter.
Okay.
I think that sounds pretty good too. I like that.
Yeah.
All right. Sue's nodding. All right. So having said that, let's take a step back. Would anyone like to weigh in on what it has been like to study this non-canonical gospel? Because that's a good place to start. Sue, do you want to start us off?
Fascinating. Just plain fascinating. And it's because the whole way it's written is different from any of the other gospels that we are used to. So it makes you think differently. Mm-hmm. Just unconsciously, you're looking at it from a different perspective. And so it makes, actually, it seems to me, given our earlier conversation about analysis and contemplativeness, the way Thomas is written is so poetic and so riddle-ridden that I think it leads to the contemplative kind of trying to sort it out because the meanings are never obvious. The meanings are hidden. Mm-hmm.
Marilyn, do you want to weigh in what it's been like to study?
This one or all, everything?
Well,
yeah, I like that I like that Thomas is different because, I mean, all my growing up years, you know, it was the attitude, well, I mean, you're reading the Bible and however it says or whatever it says, that's right. You know, and I mean, there is no right or wrong. It's this person's interpretation and that one's, and I like having one that's obviously different from what I was used to. And it just, it makes more sense to have another point of view or another interpretation or whatever. And I think the more we get of those, I think the better off we are.
Thank you. Jeanette, what about you? What has it been like to study this non-canonical gospel?
Well, I have found it very interesting and I'm very happy and glad that we did this, learned a lot from it, and learned a lot about the Gnostic viewpoint of this particular commentary person. But I have found it fascinating, you know, this, and learned a lot about different concepts and different, you know, ways of looking at different interpretations of the scripture. So,
Sue?
Growing up Catholic, you didn't have a choice of how you were thinking. So it's either the church's way or you weren't. And that had caused me a lot of problems all the way through my life. And this has given me the freedom to sort of think and sort myself out. So it's been a revelation.
Good, good. For me, the Gospel of Thomas, I'm really glad I did not encounter the Gospel of Thomas before I went to seminary and before I felt more comfortable letting go of some of the extremely conservative aspects of my youth. Because the Gospel of Thomas might have just made me cry otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Like which ones in particular, Sarah? Which ones were threatening to you and your beliefs?
That's a good question. I think the most threatening aspect of the way I was raised to understand biblical wisdom was biblical inerrancy. Meaning, not just that the Bible is never wrong, but that there is a literal truth to the Bible that is properly interpreted only by fill in the blank, because it really depends on who you are and where you come from. And so just like Sue was saying, it's properly interpreted only by the Roman Catholic Church. It's properly interpreted only by my conservative priest. It's properly interpreted by only by fill in the blank, whoever is your authority figure. And so once I was able to let go of that, which was a process that was somewhat fraught, because I really thought I was going to go to hell. Once I let go of that, and I realized that I didn't actually want to worship a God who was willing to do that, and that there were lots of Christians out there who were pretty certain that God wasn't going to do that if I started asking questions, then I felt a lot more comfortable actually asking questions. And asking questions of the branch of religion that raised me, and asking questions of God. And for me, I've often thought that I've never had a crisis of faith, but I've often had a crisis of religion. Because I have never doubted the existence of God. I have never doubted that God truly and deeply loves me more than I can comprehend. I have never doubted that God forgives and that God is more merciful even than was presented to me as a child. I've never doubted these things. I have often doubted the way God is portrayed. the stories that people tell about God. And once I was given, shall we say, enough elbow room to contemplate the idea that somebody might be telling a story about God that is not true, then I had the emotional elbow room, the spiritual elbow room, the intellectual elbow room to start trying to really forge my own relationship with God. And able to do that, the Gospel of Thomas has been wonderfully eye-opening. And it helps that I've made a small study of the context of the culture that Jesus came from. And that that has helped hugely in my preaching, in my understanding, in my leading of Bible studies. And I don't pretend to understand every aspect of the culture of Palestine at year one, but I understand it a lot more than I did, say, in seminary, and a lot more than I did growing up, attending adult Bible studies as a child, because that's how I roll.
Mm-hmm. There, Liz, excuse me, can I interrupt for a second? Could you move to your left a bit? Your face is half cut off for me. Could you move over?
Hello.
Can I ask a question too?
Good. That's better.
I'm interrupting you.
Go on, Marilyn.
I just wondered if you had a thought on why it was that God or that Jesus chose Thomas to be part of the really close group, his disciples.
You know, that's a good question. And I don't really have a good answer for it.
I mean, maybe it was because he had doubts. I don't know, but that doesn't seem
right. Well, and
sometimes that seems like the right answer, but not always.
Well, and that's a little piece. You know, when we look at that part of the post-resurrection Jesus, the medieval church has done a number on Thomas. First of all, we call him Doubting Thomas. But look at the situation. All the disciples were in a room locked for fear, and Thomas was not in the room full of fearful students. And he wasn't there to experience this moment of the risen Christ. And when he heard about it later, he's like, yeah, whatever, you guys are delusional. Okay, that happened. But think for a moment. Thomas wasn't locked in a room for fear. Thomas was out living his life. So Thomas was very different than all the rest of the students. When Jesus died, Thomas could still function. Thomas was not locked in the room. And it wasn't that he stopped associating with the rest of the disciples, because he clearly met them on a regular basis. But the whole situation comes about because he wasn't at a place where a bunch of the rest of them were. And when they told him, he kind of rolled his eyes and said, yeah. I don't fault him for rolling his eyes at them, especially if they were in the grip of a deep fear that he didn't have. And I don't fault him for doubting. And so then what do we have? We have a disciple who's not one of the main four canonical gospel disciples. But Jesus had a lot of close friends and students who were not part of the four main canonical gospel point of view disciples. Mary and Lazarus are one of them, or two of them. Martha arguably is a third. And we're told in more than one of the canonical gospels that Jesus was very close to that family. Now, you can go out on a theological limb and say Jesus was actually married to the woman named Mary, whose sister was Martha and whose brother was Lazarus. But without even going out on that theological limb, the Gospels still say that they were close personal friends of Jesus. And we do have non-canonical Gospels from their point of view that were found along with the Gospel of Thomas. There's a Gospel of Mary, there's a Gospel of Philip. There are more Gospels that are in more fragmentary. We don't have anything like completeness.
Sarah, do you recommend that we read the other Gospels in the Nag Hammadi?
Right. So as a point of interest, if you're curious about them, by all means, read them. Mm-hmm. I haven't studied them as closely as I've studied the Gospel of Thomas, so okay. I can't recommend them on a theological level.
Okay.
I can't look at them and say, yeah, these ones are grade A challenging theology. You're not going to be led astray. I don't know. But just because we have the four canonical Gospels doesn't mean that those four were Jesus's closest friends or his best students. I mean, Peter, we don't have a Gospel of Peter. And Peter was the head of the Roman church. We don't have a Gospel of James. I think there's a non-canonical Gospel of James. I think, I'm not sure, don't quote me on that. We don't have a Gospel of James, who was a younger brother of Jesus, but he was the head of the church in Jerusalem once Jesus died. And so there's a lot that we do know about the life of Jesus. And there's a lot that we know about his teachings, because his teachings have been really well preserved. But there's a lot we don't know. And, you know, why should there be a Gospel of Thomas? Why should there be a Gospel of Philip? Well, really, why shouldn't there be a Gospel of every single one of his very closest disciples? Because they all went out and founded churches. They all turned into what you and I might consider a traveling church planting priest. And they all went out and preached extensively everywhere they went. And they stayed in people's homes and told them stories that changed their lives and converted people like nobody's business. And in that way, just like the four canonical gospel stories and their authors, in that way, they gathered students and their students absorbed their stories. And the only one that we have really clear context for, really clear context, is actually Thomas. And that is only because legend had it that Thomas traveled all the way to India. That by the time he was finishing traveling and actually got killed, he had made it to India. And he had been spreading the gospel as he went and teaching the good news of Jesus Christ as he went. And that was thought to be legend until the British got to South India. And of course they brought the missionaries because the missionaries were the vanguard of capitalism and colonization. And when they got there and they started evangelizing, whole villages in southern India were already Christian. And they traced it back to Thomas. And it had been the same people living in that village generation after generation, century after century, until what, 18 centuries later, the British came and discovered, well, they have Jesus, but they're doing it wrong. because of course it didn't look like an Anglican worship, but they knew Jesus Christ and they knew gospel stories and they were following the wisdom and they considered themselves followers of the way of Jesus. And yeah, there was some stuff, you know, there was some Hinduism woven in there like a braid, because that's actually what happens everywhere that gets colonized. And it happens in the Celtic areas, which is why Celtic Christianity has a different flavor than any other kind of Christianity. But that was one of the eye-opening moments of colonization. And I think it was a beautiful moment. And we actually have, in my generation of priests in the Episcopal Church, there is a woman who is an American, but her parents were from one of those little villages in southern India. And they did some DNA testing there, and everybody had been in that village and they hadn't moved. And they just been living in that village for generations and generations and centuries and centuries. And her family had been Christian since Thomas. I mean, whoa, like hearing part of her story was just like, well, hot damn. I can't say that. I definitely can't say that because I've got all kinds of crazy Germanic heritage and British and Irish and
Viking.
I've got a tad of Viking. Yeah, like I'm a Heinz 57 of Europe, plus Cuba and some Indian in there. Like it gets crazy in my background. But so this was part of her story one day when we were all sitting around and we were sharing. And I thought to myself, why isn't this more widely known? Oh, well, because, you know, the rest of the church just takes it as a legend that Thomas got to India. But there are families and villages who have passed down the story and they very clearly remember him. And so in that way, it's maybe less confounding because very few places are so remote and isolated such that their population just stays where they are, undisturbed, unannoyed, undiluted from other influences. And you don't get that in Poland, and you don't get that in Turkey, and you don't get that in Germany or France or the Iberian Peninsula or Northern Africa. In all of those other places, you get a lot of influx of new ideas and new people, and they're part of trading routes, and you can see how the influence from one place goes to another and how ideas can get distributed very easily, but also lost very easily. And so for me, it is more surprising that we don't have more gospel accounts of Jesus. And so when we find more, I'm like, oh goody, what flavor will these ones be? Because every single one of his students took his teachings and went out and did something constructive with them. Every single one.
Perhaps lots of them didn't write. You know, They had the words, but they didn't have the ability or the money to have somebody write it down.
Right, because not everybody was literate. I mean, they
Was not Peter literate?
Well, not everybody was literate to be able to write. Yeah, so there's different levels.
There was a fisherman. I can't imagine that he would have been.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, there's, so ancient Israel, and thinking about first century Palestine, actually had a much higher literacy rate, archaeologists and biblical scholars suspect, than their surrounding culture. A much higher literacy rate. But by that, let me be clear, I don't mean the women. It would have been men only. And it would have been in order to read the Torah and to read the Tanakh, which would be sort of the accumulated writings, which include the Torah, but then also the prophets and also the other writings. And so they had a higher literacy rate, but it wasn't 100% of all men. And just because you could read the Torah didn't mean that you could write in Hebrew or any other language, because there's two sides of literacy, right? There's being able to read with comprehension and being able to write with fluency. And Thomas, or one of his students, was clearly able to write. Paul, not actually a student of Jesus, he was a latecomer to the game, clearly able to write, but also used an amanuensis. He also used a secretary who wrote most of his letters. And we know that because occasionally he makes a comment in some of the letters that says, no, I'm writing this with my own hand, and you can see how big I make my letters. And, you know, this Sunday, we're going to read almost all of Philemon, which is a really short one chapter letter of Paul. And it's about the slave Onesimus. And I mean, it's a great story, and it's a wonderful example of Paul packing your bags for a guilt trip, because that is absolutely what he is doing. But he also at some point says, you know, I am writing this with my own hand. And that tells us that he often used a secretary, but he was in prison and he was writing his own letters.
Can I ask a question?
Do it.
I'm sorry. And sometimes he would have been, one moment, Jeanette, and he mm-hmm. would have given the utensils by someone who had come to take care of him. Possibly it was Onesimus, because he mentions that in the letter. Jeanette, what's your question?
Move off onto a different topic, if you don't mind, for a moment.
No, go for it.
Another basic issue that bothers me, and it comes up in a lot of these logions, concept of unity seems to be emphasized. And like in Logion 61 in the commentary this author, says, mm-hmm. a totally open human being is not formless, but is instead capable of allowing the one, capital O, to manifest, meaning God, right? And then
yes.
the unity with a capital U, I assume meaning God, of all things then becomes manifest in and through that human form. Now, what does he mean by the unity of all things? Is this, we're talking about physical and spiritual things? And well, God, and I mean, this. There's always been an explicit separation between the creator and that which is created. And now if we talk about the unity of all things, it seems like we're confusing things again.
Mm-hmm. So I think here, first of all, he's not talking about physical.
Well, he's not what?
I don't think that he's talking about physical unity.
Okay.
Because, you know, if we wanted to achieve physical unity, then we could blow everything up. And then we would be one big united cloud of debris. And that's not where we're going with this. So we're talking about spiritual unity. And I think his point is more that we humans have created a false division between the creator and the created, and that it was not God's intention to be divided from God's creation. Now, as we think about that in our language, we can't even talk about it without dividing those two. We can't even talk about the creator being divided from the creation without saying, well, yes, there's a division, because you just did the hand signals and then there's the this over here and then there's the this over here. But again, that is where language betrays us in our capacity to even talk about the unity of God. And I think what he's trying to get us to try to wrap our minds around, which is tricky, so there's that, is the idea that God is one, first of all, but we are also one with God because God made us. And that even though we can't describe that in a way that feels satisfactorily unitary, it is. And if we just let our minds go soft for a moment, we might be able to feel and experience the oneness, even though we can't find words to perfectly and adequately describe what we're feeling. Oneness is a big deal, especially when you get into the theology and people who espouse the theology of non-duality, which we talked about at the beginning of all of this, because this commentary certainly embraces non-duality. And so if non-duality is the way you think the universe actually runs behind the scenes, all of this physical stuff, this life that we lead on this physical plane, is something like a dream. And what is real is the oneness with God that we can sometimes feel. And that may be unsatisfying as an idea. And that's okay. It means that you're really not a non-dualist and that you're not ready to embrace non-dualism. And that's all right too. Now, before you have a rebuttal, Jeanette, I just want to check in and see if Marilyn, first of all, how are you doing?
Fine.
Okay. And Sue and Marilyn, do you want to weigh in on this idea of unity and non-dualism?
It just, in my mind and my limited ability to remember specifics, it just seems to me that throughout Jesus' teaching, he was telling us he was one with us and that we were one with him. We are his brothers. We are in him. And our prayers are with him and through him, in him. There's those kind of phrasings worked in so many of our prayers are in the Mass and in his teachings that it just seems like separateness was not intended.
Marilyn, what do you think about this?
I'm not sure, because I don't think I have a real grasp of the feeling of separation versus the feeling of being one. I just don't quite feel it.
I don't think any of us do. I don't think any of us have a real secure understanding or that they're happy with. I don't, so I'm with you.
The one thing that was my biggest problem all the way through my life, and like you were talking about your situation, it was the one thought that we were preached that our faith was the only faith. Nobody else was getting in the door. And purgatory was a big part of that. So those two elements of separateness and of you join me or you're out sort of attitude. And in my family, my little unit of my own family were the only Catholics. Everybody else that we loved in our family was anyone of a number of different faiths. So that meant all these people I loved were outside the gate and I couldn't get them in. And that to me was the most tragic part of my life, my growing up years. I cried, I prayed. My mother kept telling me that in my house there are many mansions, and she would tell me that over and over. It became like a mantra before we knew what a mantra was. And so I think that when I make comments like I made a few minutes ago, I think that's so ingrained in me, that fear of that kind of separateness, that I cannot accept separateness. I have to have a faith in God that I'm part of, and he's part of me.
And I had a similar situation growing up, not the same at all, but I lived in a multi-ethnic neighborhood. It was, you know, a well-off Williamsville multi-ethnic neighborhood, because it's near the university. And my best friends were Roman Catholic, Hindu, and Jewish.
Why?
And those were just, those were the children who lived closest to me, next door, catty corner, and across the street. Like, that's just
circumstance.
Just circumstance. But those were my best friends as a small child. And the one who had been there since I was very, very young was my Jewish best friend. And at 5 years old, little Sarah had internalized the message she had received that I have to evangelize, I have to save my friends or they're going to go to hell. And so I tried at five. And it made my best friend sad. And it hurt her feelings. And at five, I realized that my priest was wrong. I didn't have the words to try to explain that. And I knew better than to even try to explain it. But I just very quietly stopped trying to save my friends. But the anguish inside of me did not stop, because it did not feel right. And I was five to have that level of disagreement with an authority figure. And it did not feel right that God would so profoundly punish someone who was as good and nice and lovely as my best friend, just for being a good Jew, or at least a moderately good Jew, a somewhat observant Jew. You know, she was also five. And so I grew up with a great amount of dissonance in my life, a deep faith in God from parents who had a deep faith in God with a slightly mystical bent and a conservative spin. And what that meant is that I desperately felt that I ought to be evangelizing and saving and telling everybody about the story of Jesus Christ. And I was also very aware that that is not what people want. They don't want to hear it. And the bias of my parents was such that they were much more comfortable with me coming home with coloring pages of Shiva and eating kosher at my friend's house than saying anything about the Virgin Mary. Because, like, okay, you know, we have to be open-minded when it comes to other religions, but Roman Catholics are out. And, you know, that was the bias of my parents. And, you know, and all of those families were lovely people. Like, they were all lovely people. They were good neighbors. They were kind. They were giving. And their children were great. And there was great food at everybody's house. I can attest to that. Because the Roman Catholics owned a pizzeria.
That would make perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. They owned La Hacienda Brighton. And so, you know, it was a strange way to grow up with all of these forces pulling me in different directions. But the way forward that I found was that I could not trust religion. I could only trust God. Which is interesting as a priest, because I still don't trust religion, even though I am part of its hierarchy. But I do trust God. And I do experience, occasionally, oneness with God. And it's got nothing to do with physicalness. And it's got everything to do with kind of being inside the mind of my creator and realizing I've never left. Now, does that make sense in a physical way? No, no, it doesn't. Do I need it to make sense in a physical way? No, no, I don't. But that's my experience, which is going to be necessarily different than your experience.
I remember at one time, I think it was talking to Vicky, but and it was about prayer, talking to God and prayer. And my prayer time is, it's very important, you know, and I feel that need, but I also feel that life is a constant conversation with God, no matter what you're doing, all the time. Mm-hmm. I find myself talking, you know, I mean, not to the point of neglecting getting down on my knees, but it just seems like he's always there and I can always talk to him. Her.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And that's I don't know
mm-hmm. Well, and I think that being in a place of constantly in conversation with God is one aspect of the goal of the Christian life and of the spiritual life. To walk quietly with our Maker would be another way to put it. To constantly invite God's opinion on what to do and where to go and how to say, and constantly be open to the presence of God and discerning, is this really God? Is this really God? I don't know if this is really God. I'm going to think about this some more.
Also, I feel very important to thank God for the blessings that we enjoy constantly, little ones and big ones. I mean, it's the little things in life that make you happy sometimes, you know, right. And I think that's really critical.
And I've heard someone, and I don't think this is splitting hairs, but, you know, of course, we can argue about that, talk about sort of the attitude of gratitude, but it's not meant to be a thought. It's meant to be a feeling, kind of letting the gratitude seep in and just hold that space open and just being so grateful for this mm-hmm. thing or this yep. moment or this person, mm-hmm. or this relationship yep. or this affirming word, you know, whatever it is that you're grateful for. And that idea that the more often we are grateful, the less often we are complaining and miserable.
True.
And so isn't it a good idea to be grateful a larger percentage of the time? And I dig it.
It becomes mm-hmm. a habit.
It does. It becomes a habit. Just like complaining can be a habit and worrying can be a habit and being angry can be a habit. Actively being grateful can be a habit. And so, my friends, I am grateful for you.
And we for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for coming. It was lovely leading Bible study for you. And I'll see you around.
Mm-hmm. And definitely, I am very thankful for all these Bible study sessions we've had. They've been wonderful, educational. I've learned a lot and enjoyed the experience. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think all right. We all feel that way. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'll see you around.
Okay, take care.
So, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.